the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good Monday morning. According to FreshPlaza.com, there's a shortage of tomatoes in the U.S. due to a few reasons. One is the transition of the season. California just about wrapped up its season, and Florida is the only other region with production happening now. But Florida also planted less tomatoes this year, and the other region, our Mexican neighbors, where we import tomatoes from, also planted less. Moving on to today's show. Brian German is talking with us about how food waste startups received considerable amounts of funding this past year. And Taylor Hillman is sharing with us a story on nighttime work regulations and how they're quietly moving fast. And I'm starting off the show today with some news of the usage of chlorpyrifos and its new recommended restrictions. Let's jump right in. California regulators have recommended new restrictions of the chemical chlorpyrifos, which is currently used on many different California crops. According to an AP report, the Department of Pesticide Regulation issued temporary guidelines for chlorpyrifos that include banning it from crop dusting, as well as use on most common crops and increasing boundaries on where it can be applied. Chemical company Dow DuPont uses chlorpyrifos on 60 different crops, many of which are grown here in California, including grapes, almonds, and oranges. The action by California regulators comes as the state proposes to identify the pesticide as a, quote, toxic air contaminant that poses a risk of serious illness or death. When the proposed identification and ban announcement came in August, California Citrus Mutual President Joel Nelson said,
"We'll probably move forward with other materials and have to apply more AI to do it. We'll lose, I don't know what we have as an alternative to go after the ants, which goes after the beneficial insects that we use in the Southern California area to go after the Asian citrus psyllid. The dots have got to get connected. And, you know, we're not using these materials indiscriminately. There's a safe harbor provision for using crop protection tools. There's massive modeling that dictates how infinitesimal you can apply this and when you can apply it and how you can apply it. And there's a lot of alternative science that specifically states that this is not a bad tool."
Dow DuPont spokesperson Greg Schmidt disagreed with the recommended restrictions, saying it would hurt growers who widely rely on the pesticide. Here's Taylor Hillman with another agriculture update.
A few years into production has given growers time to adjust to mummy nut risks in a new almond variety. The self-fertile almond variety Independence came out a few seasons ago, and one of the characteristics growers saw was that it was tougher to shake. Blue Diamond growers Ben Gowdy said growers have learned a few things since then to get those mummy nuts out of the trees.
As a young tree, it is a pretty good producer. Early on, people, if they're not harvesting, they will end up with mummy nuts in those trees, and so they need to be diligent about getting those mummy nuts out in the wintertime so that they don't establish a bad navel orange worm footing. From the shaking standpoint, it looks like as the tree ages and as the nuts move out on those laterals, it gets a little easier to shake. But there's also some considerations that need to take place, such as nutrient, nitrogen management. I'm told that nitrogen early, no later than about May 15th, is the best plan.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Though the fires here in California blazed across the state, the devastation was felt nationwide. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue talks about the importance of forest management in USDA Stephanie Ho's report.
Amidst devastating wildfires in California, two cabinet secretaries made a joint call for improving forest management.
These are called disasters, and they are, because of the loss of life. Wildland fire has been greater than hurricanes this year. We've had two significant hurricanes, but the death toll is surpassing that.
That was USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue, whose agency includes the U.S. Forest Service. He was joined by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who recently traveled to Paradise, California.
I've never seen anything like it. I grew up in Montana. The devastation and the speed of which that fire came through, it was literally like a flamethrower of embers.
And he added, now is the time to act.
There are active forest management principles that we need to go forward on. One is to remove the dead and dying trees, to thin, do prescribed burns late in the season rather than mid-season.
Ag Secretary Perdue will be in California next week.
Perdue adds,
we're way behind the curve, and that's evidenced by the amount of wildland fires that we see and the amount of devastation each year that we're back-to-back record years. So it'll take years, but it's like someone said, the best time to plant a tree is 100 years ago. but the next best time is today, and that's what we want to do is get started.
And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
As federal agencies work to address food waste, a recent report has found that there has been tremendous investment from the private sector to fund companies also looking to tackle the issue of food waste. In a report from ReFed, the first 10 months of 2018 have generated $125 million of investment in companies aimed at reducing the amount of food that goes to waste. That figure only represents investment from American firms, as an estimated $218 billion worth of food is wasted in the U.S. each year. With food waste being a global issue, other countries have also seen varying levels of investment in methods and technologies to address the problem. French, Swedish, and Israeli companies have all secured significant amounts of funding for various technologies that help to curb overall food waste. While private investment has been geared more toward technological solutions to prevent food waste, public and philanthropic groups have also been helping to finance food waste solutions by supporting food banks and other food recovery programs. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
The Natural Resources Conservation Service can provide individual assistance for farms looking to implement sustainable ag practices. NRCS soil conservationist Drew Mather was recently recognized for his work with Cantonese farmers in Silicon Valley, which resulted in significant reductions in fertilizer use. He noted the benefits of a more individual approach in educating farmers on new techniques.
We held workshops talking specifically about how to calculate the amount of fertilizer that you're putting on to a particular field, also having workshops related to irrigation water management and just how much nitrogen comes in through your irrigation water, doing soil testing with the growers. That effort, doing these workshops, both larger workshops as well as smaller one-on-one workshops, I felt like that was very helpful. It is fairly individualized and depends on the growers that you're working with. Sometimes you have to try to dig and try to find a different way to explain something when it relates to soil fertility or taking a soil test.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Talks on new nighttime work safety requirements have quietly progressed and may be here soon. The new agricultural operations that take place from sunset to sunrise regulation started conversations in 2014, but those talks died down shortly after. AgSafe President and CEO Amy Wolf said she recently talked with Cal OSHA, and not only is the new regulation still progressing, but it could be reviewed as early as the first quarter of 2019.
The safety engineer at Cal OSHA, who had been assigned to this task, had been working very diligently to get financial data from all of the agricultural groups. But as we both know, growers are very leery of providing financial data to a government agency. And so I think what happened in the process is that they moved ahead without us, which is always scary, and have just been chipping away at it. And that's how we find ourselves now almost at the end of the financial review.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, USDA and the livestock industry are among partners in efforts to keep foreign animal disease threats out of our borders. In a report from Rod Bain, that includes strategies like detector dogs at U.S. airports and port facilities.
The Beagle Brigade over the last month has been getting some much-deserved publicity.
Joe Cool.
Well, yeah, but while that particular beagle is combating the Red Baron, his canine cousins trained at the Agriculture Department's National Detector Dog Training Center in Georgia have been making our borders safe from incoming pests and diseases by sniffing out prohibited ag products, like one such beagle at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport did by finding a roasted pig head. Recognizing the importance of the Beagle Brigade's daily duties is Liz Wagstrom.
Those beagles are our first line of defense. We have a lot of international travelers who are coming from a lot of places that have diseases we don't want, and they may not know that they shouldn't be bringing in meat products. They may come from a culture that feeds meat scraps to pigs. So we need to make sure that that first line of defense is in place.
The chief veterinarian of the National Pork Producers Council says over the next year, her organization plans to work closely with USDA and its Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service and Customs and Border Patrol to beef up the Beagle Brigade.
Do we have all the beagles we need? What are the barriers to having more? Is there anything we as industry can do to advocate for increasing the number if we need to?
Wagstrom says the Beagle Brigade is just one part of what she calls a three-legged stool, consisting of prevention, preparedness, and protection that will be needed to keep the threat of African swine fever away from our nation's pork producers.
African swine fever is a viral disease of swine that's deadly, and it's also considered trade-limiting. We really need to focus on two of the three legs of that stool, so prevention and preparedness to keep it out, as well as the laboratory network to be able to immediately identify it and help us control it, because there is no vaccine for African swine fever. Likely not going to be a vaccine anytime soon.
And she adds efforts to prevent African swine fever and other diseases will involve partnership with various USDA entities.
You look at the research efforts on both foot-mouth disease as well as African swine fever have been very important. So that's been important, but also has been our USDA partnerships with import-export to make sure we're importing safe products.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And last week, New York Democrat Kristen Gillibrand said President Trump should reject any farm bill that does not include a refund for dairy farmers who participated in the Margin Protection Program. Gillibrand, who serves on the Senate Ag Committee, urged Trump in a letter to only support a final bill that includes her Dairy Premium Refund Act that she says would issue a refund to farmers who participated in the failed Dairy Margin Protection Program. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Ever Greiner is next.
One of America's largest food chains doesn't have a single butcher. They don't need one. They only need somebody to open the cartons and place the meat packages on the counter. Few people can even remember when beef or pork was delivered in bulk. Yeah, I mean, a half a cow or a whole hog. The butcher cut it into proper portions and displayed it inside the counter cooler. Whole carcasses are only found at packing plants now. But it's cheaper this way. Assembly line production, cheaper shipping, and of course those high-paying butcher jobs are all gone. One thing hasn't changed. Well, not much anyway. That's the way beef is raised. See, it's still a seven-day-a-week job for the farmer or the rancher to do the endless array of jobs it takes to raise a cow. If anything, his job is a lot more difficult today than it was before. Another example where food production is easier for everybody except where it begins. That's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Alan Huddleston with USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, is announcing the Defend the Flock campaign.
It's focused on protecting U.S. poultry from the spread of infectious poultry diseases through every day, every time practice of good biosecurity.
He says the message is aimed at both backyard poultry owners as well as the commercial poultry industry.
USDA had developed the backyard campaign following the exotic Newcastle disease outbreak in 2002 and 2003, and we added a commercial campaign following the HPAI outbreak in 2014-2015.
He says both campaigns were each considered successful, but that the new combined campaign stresses an overall message that poultry biosecurity efforts need to be sustained.
As we've learned from experience, biosecurity is not really a sprint to the finish. It's an avian health marathon.
Why did APHIS launch its campaign now?
When we consider the devastating impact of the highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak in 2014 to 2015, as well as other poultry health issues we've seen in the last couple of years, including the VND outbreak in California this year, we feel that the timing is right.
VND stands for virulent Newcastle disease.
Biosecurity matters all the time. And our newly refreshed Defend the Flock campaign with new available resources shares that sentiment for everyone involved with poultry. Continuously keeping our guard up against disease is the best protection we can give to flocks across the nation.
There is a host of useful information available online on a new Defend the Flock webpage.
That has some existing as well as new resources for visitors, including some very helpful checklists for specific biosecurity principles.
The checklists can serve as good reminders to anyone who wants them and also will be available in other languages.
Currently, they're provided in English. In December, they'll be provided also in Spanish, and we intend to add additional languages throughout the coming year.
APHIS is hosting an information webinar on November 28th, so go online to find out more information or to register. The best way to bring up the new webpage is to go to usda.gov and search for Defend the Flock. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
How much it will cost you to raise backyard chickens. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Dreams of having farm-fresh eggs every day could very well become a reality, but there are costs associated with this dream you should be mindful about. How much you'll need to shell out for backyard chickens depends on the types of chickens you keep and how you're looking after them. Some of the more expensive breeds could cost up to $100 or more. Housing can get a bit pricey too, especially when considering all of the materials that will be needed. A good quality crop is around $370 and can easily accommodate a few birds. If you need to install fencing, you might need to spend at least $60 more. Other costs you'll need to consider include finding a useful litter and parasite prevention products. Feeders and drinkers will be needed, as well as the ongoing expense of chicken feed. Our feathered friends will also require routine care of deworming. And if a trip to the veterinarian is needed, be prepared for the costs associated with an office consultation. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West, and welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. Chile Colorado. What does that translate? Spelling-wise, it looks like Chile Colorado, but actually Colorado would be color. And the reason why this is so important right here is because the color of certain kinds of chilies really is something to be appreciated and to understand, especially in Hispanic style Mexican cuisine. Now, there's different variations of chile colorado, but the way I like to do it is more simple. It's more of a mild flavor, as if we wanted to make it spicier, we would add more spicy chili. This is a mild flavor so the whole family can enjoy. Let's get started. The very first thing we need to do is we need to make sure to use the guajillo chilies. I take 1 pound of clean guajillo chilies, and I'm going to go ahead and add to that 1/4 pound of arbol chilies. Now, I like to put them in my pan, or actually into a medium sauce pot. Now, if you're making this for a lot of people, obviously we're going to make more than this, but this chili does go a long way. It's got really great flavor, especially on top of some roasted chicken. I'm going to add to this 1 whole Spanish onion, which is a yellow onion. I'm going to also add to this 3 tablespoons of garlic olive oil. We're going to bring this to a saute, and it's very important that we get some color on the chilies, but don't cook the chilies. We're not cooking the chilies at all. We're just trying to put a little bit of a toast onto them and get the onions to become translucent. Once that happens, I'm going to add chicken stock to this, 1.5 quarts to be exact. And then I'm going to go ahead and bring this to a high heat so that way we could come to a boil. Once we come to a boil, I will let this go to a simmer and I will let it simmer for 1 hour. And the reason why I do it for 1 hour is I want to get a proper reduction on this. After it's reduced for 1 hour, I will blend everything together, run it through a sieve, and then we're going to thicken it up with some xanthan gum. And the xanthan gum, we're always going to use it to taste. We're never going to put a whole bunch of xanthan gum in there, but just enough to taste what we're doing and enjoy. For this and many more of my recipes, check me out at www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgMet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agmetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City Newsday. I'm Danielle Leo. We heard them chat a little bit on Friday about the new agriculture operations that take place from sunset to sunrise and how they may be placed on the industry pretty soon. We now rejoin Taylor Hillman's interview with AgSafe Amy Wolf about the new regulations.
I think that's the interesting thing there is 360 degrees. So a simple headlamp off the front, that's not going to work anymore.
No, it's not. And in fact, what you're going to see happen is that we're now going to be challenged with this combination of not only the individual's lighting requirements, but in order to provide that broader lighting, you're either A, modifying the warranty on your piece of equipment to add lighting to it, because you and I both know John Deere tractors don't come with lights so bright that they're going to project off and keep that worker in that 10-foot sphere, or you're going to find yourself running afoul of the California Air Resources Board because you're using diesel-powered stadium telescoping lights that now create air emission challenges. I mean, we're really going to be at a crossroads of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't when it comes to the amount of light you have to provide.
There's also some in there about lighting pathways and restrooms and all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's not just the workers either.
Correct. And so one of the things that came out of those 2 years of the advisory group working together was this issue of what are the hazards that we see most commonly when working at night? And one of them is, if you think about how operations function during the daytime, you know, you've got folks who are moving along. Again, we could be harvesting table grapes now during the daytime. And when it's time to take a break, we break and workers, you know, loosely scatter, you know, seek shade, use a shade structure. But there isn't, and oftentimes, particularly when weather isn't an issue, there aren't defined parameters about where workers need to take their rest breaks, nor are there defined parameters about where workers need to congregate for the start of their shift and where they need to congregate for the end of their shift. And because of the concerns around slip, trip, and fall hazards, and because of the concerns around the potential interaction with equipment, they're now saying that you have to designate safe areas for the start, the end, of a shift, as well as for the rest break. So you have to you have to be very specific about this is where we come together to start, this is where we come together to end, and this is where you need to go to take your break. Going so far as to not only verbally communicate that, but have that on a map for workers to be able to visually see as well.
Yeah, sounds like a lot. Like you said, this is coming pretty quickly. We could see this, come to approval next year. I'm assuming the public comment period is way gone on this. I mean, there's nothing producers or the industry can do about this now, right?
No, they still can. So what's happened is the input period for the crafting of the language to go to the standards board, that period is come and gone. But legally, when the standards board takes up a potential new standard, they have to open up comment period for stakeholders. So that's the good news of what is still coming. And, you know, and to be quite honest, the standards board would really have to have their act together to get this thing pulled together in 2019. I think it's more likely that the process of bringing this thing to law will happen in 19 to take effect in 20. And let me just touch off, there's a couple other elements that are important for folks to know. Mm-hmm. They're now codifying in the standard that you have to provide reflective clothing for your workers. There's been a lot of discussion about this already being a requirement under the general safety order. They're taking the next step and making sure it is crystal clear. There's no ambiguity. You will have to provide either reflective vests, jackets with reflective tape, but you will have to be the one as the employer who provides reflective clothing. You are going to have to do like we've had to do with heat illness working in the outdoors. You will now have to have a separate plan specific for working safely at night. So while Cal OSHA has long argued that if you're working at night, that should already be something you're doing in your injury and illness prevention program, again, we're taking things one step further and saying, you've got your IIPP, you got that heat illness plan, now you got to have a night safety work plan as well. It has to be a separate standalone document. You've got to make sure you've got a way to account for your workers, a system for accounting for your workforce. So essentially ensuring that because you're out there in the dark, you do a head count at the start of the night and you do a head count when the shift comes to an end, making sure that you have accounted for all of your people. How you go about doing that, as per usual, Cal OSHA is not telling you how to do it. You can come up with your own system, but you are going to have a system for accounting for your workforce. They've gone out of their way, the other lighting element, when we were talking about lighting, is they've gone out of their way to make sure that you are specifically lighting and marking your water hazards. So the idea of slip, trip, and fall fears in working at night is a big concern that came up in that advisory committee process. And so making sure any irrigation pipes, sprinkler heads, I mean, any of the possible hazards that come out of our water systems, that they have to be specifically lit and marked. And then that seventh thing, that thing that I'm betting money with our new governor is going to get thrown back into the mix, is that you have to have a traffic plan for all mobile equipment, whether it's your equipment or a third party. And this is the situation of, and unfortunately we have had some serious injuries and fatalities over the years directly connected to this, but this is third party truckers coming in to pick up the commodity that's been harvested. Again, I think of trucking companies that are coming in to pick up wine grapes that have been picked, and they're driving a specific route on the property and don't realize that there are workers out on the property. And so you would have to make sure that you have a very clear map and that you communicate that map to your workforce, that it's also communicated to whatever third-party vendors you're using. This is where equipment can travel, and this is where people can travel, and that those two cannot necessarily be the same. And that's true for trucks, 18-wheelers, but it's also true for quads, UTVs, gators, tractors, forklifts, backhoe. Anybody who's operating a piece of equipment needs to know where they can drive and where the people can go, so we don't have a potential for those two to overlap. That's the only one that's not currently in the language, but has been in and out of the language. And if I was a betting gal, given our new political dynamic in the state of California, I'm going to bet it's going to get thrown back in when the Standards Board takes this up.
Yeah, I could absolutely see that being put back in.
Stay tuned for tomorrow's show as we wrap up this interview with Amy Wolf and Taylor. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. In a report provided by the American Bankers Association, Dave Coggins, a Wisconsin banker and ABA member, gets real about the dairy industry and how some dairies are closing, others are expanding, and just tips to survive within the industry climates.
Across the nation, hundreds, if not thousands, of dairy farms are calling it quits. At the same time, other dairies are expanding. Wisconsin Ag Banker Dave Coggins says the long slump in milk prices is catching up with some farmers.
If they've made some moves in terms of adding capital to their operation, they don't have the income-producing units to cover that kind of capital, maybe got over-leveraged after 14 when prices were really high and they assumed that they were going to continue like that for a while, you get in the high teens and up to as high as $20 a hundredweight, that's just, you bleed red ink in this kind of environment.
On the flip side,
there are still expansions going on across the country that are adding cows where there is break-evens in the $15 and some cent range for Class 3. That's workable in today's environment. They've got buffer for that kind of condition.
Coggins says he empathizes with dairy families that are making the tough decision to exit the business. I asked if he could offer any insight into what he sees from the dairies that are able to hang on.
An overused term is management, but what does that really mean? It means paying attention to the little things. It's a whole bunch of little things that add up to meaningful differences in the bottom lines of those farms. And it's hard to teach that. It's hard to help identify that. But the people that understand their business, they understand their numbers, they understand technology and how to use it, how to deploy capital effectively, those kinds of producers and those kind of managers are doing okay. They've got break-evens at a level that they can sustain this kind of condition for a period of time.
Wisconsin's Dave Coggins, a member of the Ag and Rural Bankers Committee for the American Bankers Association. From the National Ag Bankers Conference in Omaha, I'm Joe Cornelli.
We've been following a report on the E. coli outbreak in romaine lettuce that's gone nationwide. And according to a report by the Salinas Californian, a USA Today affiliate, the source of the outbreak could have come from a region in California. Monterey County Ag Commissioner Henry Gonzalez said the date of the 32 reported illnesses lines up with the romaine lettuce season in the northern San Joaquin Valley. And while there's no direct or specific source of the outbreak from a farm or company, Gonzalez said it is likely to come from the Monterey and San Bernardino County area. The Grower Shipper Association of Central California started removing romaine products from store shelves as advised by the CDC and the USDA immediately. In a statement, the association said, quote, "Farmers and farmer companies are working diligently to voluntarily withdraw romaine products before they enter the commerce." The association went on to say, quote, "But we must do a better job and redouble the efforts to determine how and why this is happening so consumers can eat our products again with confidence." The article also stated that of the 32 people that fell ill due to the outbreak, 10 of those cases came from California. And now for a recap of one of today's top stories.
A few years into production has given growers time to adjust to mummy nut risks in a new almond variety. The self-fertile almond variety Independence came out a few seasons ago, and one of the characteristics growers saw was that it was tougher to shake. Blue Diamond growers Ben Gowdy said growers have learned a few things since then to get those mummy nuts out of the trees.
As a young tree, it is a pretty good producer. Early on, people, if they're not harvesting, they will end up with mummy nuts in those trees, and so they need to be diligent about getting those mummy nuts out in the wintertime so that they don't establish a bad navel orange worm footing. From the shaking standpoint, it looks like as the tree ages and as the nuts move out on those laterals, it gets a little easier to shake. But there's also some considerations that need to take place, such as nutrient nitrogen management. I'm told that nitrogen early, no later than about May 15th, is the best plan.
I'm Taylor Hillman for Agnet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow Agnet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgnetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgnetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgnetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by Agnet West.